We have three very distinct speakers with us today.
I'd like to welcome the following. So, Abdullah Andalusi, who is an international activist, a thinker, speaker and debater on Muslim and Islamic issues. We have with us Mukhtar Bursi, a management consultant and community activist who graduated from Oxford University and is also heavily involved in a range of community-based activities, and has also studied Arabic and Islamic studies in Syria and has published in the Journal of Shia Islamic Studies. Finally, we have with us Rupert Sutton, who is the co-author of The Challenging Extremists, Practical Frameworks for Our Universities. So the format of the evening is we'll each give our speakers 10 minutes to present what they have to say on the subject, and then I might pick a couple of questions or I'll open it up to the audience. We'll see how it goes. Okay, so I'd first like to welcome Rupert Sutton, please.
Yeah, sure. Thanks very much for inviting me here. It's good to be back at King's again, though. Obviously, I wasn't actually a student at this campus, which explains why I got lost on the way here. So I obviously just wanted to talk about sort of freedom of speech and expression, really, which obviously are sort of universal rights, and this kind of includes freedom of religious practice as well, and for want of a better word, theists or Muslims or Christians, it should cover your right to express outrage and anger when you feel that your religion has been attacked. And obviously the clearest example of perceived attack on religion in recent times was the controversy that followed the translation of the Innocence of Muslims video. It being posted on YouTube and sort of very unpleasant, bigoted portrayal of Islam and Muslims, which unsurprisingly provoked a pretty unhappy response around the world. However, the violence and intimidation that kind of followed this film being published was, unacceptable, really. The reaction by crowds in sort of Libya and Sudan and Yemen was unjustified and actually played into the hands of bigots who made this film by kind of allowing them to suggest, look, we said Muslims are violent and this is how they respond to our film. So how should a community, and in this case we're talking about the Muslim community, respond to insults like this? I was at a discussion event on Tuesday over at Queen Mary University, which is held by the Ahmadiyya Society over there. And students were kind of discussing this actual issue, sort of saying, how as Muslim students do we respond when our prophet is insulted in a way like this? And the consensus that everyone kind of came to was that perhaps the best way to do this is by being through the most tolerant and the most articulate community, using sort of clear argument, interfaith dialogue, disassociate yourself from the extremists on both sides of the argument, and make clear that they don't represent either side. Yet also make your feelings clear, kind of peaceful protest and expression. So if this freedom of expression is a universal right, and these guys who made this film, they put it out there and people say, well, if we can't respond to them in the way that we want to, surely that's taking their freedom of expression over our freedom of expression. Do we not have the power to stop people expressing views that upset us? I would argue it's not quite, and I would actually argue that there should be limits to freedom of expression. I'm not a freedom of speech absolutist, especially when people use freedom of speech to attack other people's rights. As a counter-extremism campaigner, it would be pretty hypocritical of me to argue for absolute freedom of speech for one side and then suggest that there are certain types of speech that shouldn't be allowed on campus. That would be not something that I could argue in good conviction. I support the NUS No Platform policy, which kind of seeks to deny a platform on campus to fascists. So right across the political spectrum, from the British National Party to groups like Hizb ut-Tahrir or Al-Muhajirin. And it kind of stops them, using the university campuses to kind of spread certain messages. So, that's the angle I think I will come at this from, considering my background and my work as a researcher, kind of looking at extremism from across the spectrum on university campuses. So, let's say, for example, a university society organised an event on campus and they were going to be showing Innocence of Muslims there. That's something that I think people should argue against, and they should stop that kind of thing being shown on campuses just because it has no positive message and it is ultimately just gratuitous insult designed to upset people. In addition to this, when people use freedom of speech as an excuse to target vulnerable groups or to incite hatred, this should be challenged wherever possible. The rights of an individual trump those of freedom of expression, in my opinion. So when speakers who have incited hatred against homosexuals or Jews or Muslims or come to speak on campus, I think we should speak out on them and make sure that people are there to challenge their views and in some cases, in the most extreme cases, to try and stop them from being allowed to express those views on campus. To give an example of the problems that this can cause, as possibly one that would even affect some people here. As we're speaking right now, an Egyptian scholar called Dr. Khalid Fikri is speaking to students at London Met. And he, you know, he's claimed that Shia are the worst and greatest enemy that faces the Ummah these days, has told his audiences that Shia believe killing a Sunni raises your rank in paradise, you know, and raping a Sunni woman is a matter that pleases Allah. And since inviting him, and this is what's really worrying, is that the Islamic Society has started liking Facebook pages that have an anti-Shia message in them, one called Reality of Shia, that they liked literally just after they invited this guy. It tells readers, Shias are not Muslims, and we must destroy all the false beliefs that were added into Islam after the death of the Prophet, you know, spreading a sort of hate-filled sectarian message, essentially. And, you know, some people might think, who cares what people like on Facebook? You know, some people like Justin Bieber, and we don't judge them for that. But having a university society liking a hate-filled sectarian page at the same time as they invite a speaker who's proposing sectarian views is possibly too much of a coincidence. And in this case, giving him the freedom to speak about this to students risks inciting hatred against Shia. It risks creating a campus environment in which students feel that they're threatened or they can't practice their religion in the way that they want. And perhaps that's something that we should be standing up against. And in that case, we should be restricting, not even necessarily restricting, but moderating someone's freedom of expression. They can't simply go onto a campus and say these kind of things. So, and this story with Shia students, it could be, you could replace that with LGBT students in the case of some speakers, or with Muslim students, or, you know, or with Jews. We at Student Rights, we recently wrote a short briefing on an expose on a group at Liverpool University called the National Culturists, which is very big on this idea of absolute freedom of speech and says, you know, on campus we're being shut down because people don't like our message. Unfortunately, their message is that Islam contaminates British culture. So what we're trying to do there is, you know, say, yes, you have a right to hold that political opinion personally, but you shouldn't be allowed to go around saying it on campus or you know, rubbing people's faces in it and saying, essentially, you know, we believe that you're not part of Britain and you shouldn't be here. I mean, that's just going to cause further problems on campus. So if these examples demonstrate freedom of expression being used to attack proponents of a religion, actions which have no other purpose essentially than to create intolerance and create division. Sorry, I've lost myself a little bit. How the personal rights of religious adherents, whilst they should be protected, religions themselves are not necessarily excused from scrutiny. You know, to make religions exempt from criticism essentially means that they have no one watching over them, they have nobody, you know, being able to stand up to people who might be bigoted. And, you know, an institution that has the power of sort of an organised religion should not be free from that kind of scrutiny, I don't think. You know, mockery might seem hurtful and can be very hurtful, but parody is possibly one of the best forms of scrutiny, and as long as it doesn't overstep sort of common decency, it shouldn't be shut down to kind of intimidation or even well-meaning bureaucracy. We saw at Reading University where the Atheist Society placed a pineapple on their freshers' fair stall that had the label Muhammad on it, and they were ejected from their society. I personally felt it was a provocative act that was clearly hurtful to students, but it didn't incite hatred. You know, it was simply trying to open discussion, possibly in a ham-fisted way. But still, that was the aim of it. It wasn't to imply that Muhammad was a pineapple or something like that. It was simply to kind of get people talking about this kind of thing. And yeah, they had the right to say that without being threatened or, in this case, thrown out of their freshers' fair. You know, you can see why people are unhappy, but you don't necessarily have the right to impose your religious sensibilities on somebody else. Buddhists don't necessarily force people to become vegetarians. Why should students not have the right to portray Muhammad? Yeah, it doesn't incite violence or hatred. If anything, people who complained about it kind of made the students' point for them by being intolerant of their right to, you know, mock a religion. I don't have a particularly long speech here, so I just kind of finish up by adding one point. I mean, one of the questions we had up on the screen was, does having freedom of speech imply there are no consequences for what is said? And I think that's a particularly apt line because, of course, we've seen in the past few weeks that there are serious consequences if you say things, without thinking about what's going to happen. Or in some cases, people know there'll be consequences to what they say and they try and say them to get a rise out of people and to cause problems. So when you're thinking about this kind of thing, I suppose you always have to take the consequences into account. But I mean, what we should kind of really get down to is that those consequences shouldn't and should never be kind of violence or intimidation or the silencing of debate that doesn't incite hatred and doesn't incite anger, doesn't incite fear of a minority or something like that. So, as I mentioned earlier, the fundamental point here is decency. You have a right to say these things, and you should have that right, and nobody can take that right away from you. But should you say that kind of thing? You should possibly step back and think before you say these things. You should think, if a person was mocking my beliefs in that way, would that make me unhappy? I should think, you should treat others as you would like to be treated yourself. The majority, I think, of us have it within us to be decent people. We have it within us to exercise our right to freedom of expression without having to target others. And I think, I believe this is the case. And I think if we can kind of come together in this, we can kind of drown out the intolerant minority who are kind of keen to use their freedom of expression to provoke and attack and hurt. That would be my kind of take on this matter. I think it'd be interesting to see what kind of views you guys have on it in the Q&A, but I'll pass over to one of these other guys now and let them pick up where I left off.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for inviting me here, and thank you for my esteemed colleagues for attending as well and participating in this, I think, very interesting and timely discussion. The issue of freedom of speech is it's generally debated between, you'll see, usually two extremes. You'll see on one extreme this kind of fundamentalist libertarian that would say all speech should be allowed and all speech should be permitted. And on the other side, obviously, you see other extremes such as, obviously, no speech which is inflammatory or non-politically correct should be said, and there's a dichotomy there. But I want to propose a more objective criterion that I think would allow human beings to achieve what freedom of speech was meant to achieve without causing social friction and problems. The purpose of freedom of speech, the very reason that there should be what is called freedom of speech, or I call it open discussion, is the pursuit of truth. That is the reason for it, is the purpose for it. If you even read John Stuart Mill's book on liberty, he discusses the pursuit of truth as the first basis and for why we should allow freedom of speech. However, it gets abused. There is abuse in this concept, because some people interpret that freedom of speech now to be the freedom to insult, even though insult gives no objective or rational benefit, or there's no benefit that insult adds to society other than hatred, rancor, victimization, harassment, offense, social discord. So there's nothing positive that insult ever actually adds to society. Instead, we see it adds negatives to society. And you see that people can feel humiliated. Now, the argument against insult is, and people very cunningly try to spin it in this kind of rubric, is that, oh well, taking offense is subjective. Anyone can take offense to anything you say. But I never said the issue is the taking of offense is the basis for something being right or wrong. I said the intention to insult. So having an intent to insult someone's beliefs, someone's race, or as my colleague just said, someone's sexual orientation. These things people find hurtful, they find distressing, it harasses them, they are emotionally hurt, and the English law is replete full of laws which basically sanction anyone intentionally hurting other people emotionally through what you say verbally. So the public order laws. So if you intend to actually insult someone, it actually has the word insult in that law. If you insult someone and you cause them harassment or you cause them a distress or alarm, then you are culpable in the law. Sexual harassment laws. Interesting enough, the sexual harassment law has a clause whereby if a person creates an offensive environment for a woman based on sexuality, an offensive, so the word offense is in the law. You could say, oh, that's subjective. Who determines what offense is? But the interesting thing is that law makes someone culpable even if they didn't intend to be sexually harassing. The law doesn't even look at intent. It just looks at the effect, and it can punish people for the effect. It's in British law. Yet when people say, I mean, all I'm advocating is equality. So if sexuality is and gender and race is something that's protected from being insulted, defamed, and humiliated, then what about something that redefines someone's belief, someone's personality and characteristics, your religion? In fact, religion is more fundamental than your skin color. Skin color is superficial. You can have, you know, different personalities even within the same skin color, so to speak, but people with the same religious belief have some consistencies in their character. It defines them, it defines their worldview, it defines how they behave, it defines their whole framework of life. So when you insult that, you actually are insulting what defines a lot of people. And it's more fundamental than race. Yet race is protected, and religion is not protected. Now, when I talk about insult, and again, people always like to conflate the insult with criticism. I'm all for criticism. Nothing is taboo in terms of what you want to criticize intellectually. You can criticize if God exists. You can criticize the Prophet Muhammad. You can say he was a false prophet if you wish, or he was mad, or, as people have said in the past, even in classical Islamic discourse with non-Muslims in our history. And that's fine. The Prophet Muhammad had, you know, one of the first Muslim-Christian debates in the first ever mosque for 3 days with the Christians of Najran. And they denied him he was a prophet, which basically is implying he's a liar or he's mad. And they weren't sanctioned by the Prophet Muhammad. It was part of a debate. And they were. And after the end of that debate, they didn't convert to Islam. So he concluded an amicable peace treaty with them and even allowed them to use the mosque for prayers, for Christian prayers, before leaving. So this is how the Prophet Muhammad dealt with intellectual criticism, and that's fine. But gratuitous insult is a different matter. Some people seem to feel that that gratuitous Tourette's is better substance than objective argument. And this is the problem that I think we face. And I'm not just saying this in terms of, oh, well, you know, I'm a Muslim. If someone says something about Islam, I'll get angry. No, I've had many debates with many non-Muslims on Islam. They've said some, you know, many critical things, very strongly worded things, but that was fine. The intention was debate, it was discussion, it was criticism. That's fine. But gratuitous insult, I think we all reasonably know. Reasonable people who have common sense know when something is intended to insult you. And the courts, you know, look at this all the time. All the time they review case after case, looking at intent, looking at emotional feelings being hurt, and awarding damages based on that. So this is not alien to the British legal system anyway. All I'm saying is apply equally, and you will get you'll get kind of social harmony, but I still allow criticism, intellectual development, and most importantly, the pursuit of truth. So these are the kind of things which I would come is the position that I take, and I take it based on what Islam says is the issue to how to deal with these problems. Now, there is on the other extreme, and there are those who basically wish to ban people, organizations based on ideas which are not conformist to the liberal paradigm. So some people who are, okay, I'll describe this, the far right, the fascists, yes, I disagree with them, I even debate them. But intellectual discussion should be free and open if it's for the pursuit of truth. I would advise such people to read John Stuart Mill's discussion, where he said even the most vulgar ideas, you know, should be discussed intellectually. And that way, you know, you shouldn't fear, because the strongest idea will win. So unless fascists actually have a point, you shouldn't be so afraid of them. You can debate them. Yeah, let them come to universities and let them be publicly refuted. Where's the fear of this? Likewise, organizations, I mean, within the kind of sectarian milieu in a lot of in Western discourse, which is itself sectarian, people will call each other fascists or call each other extremists. Even those who are not extremists. So groups which are not violent, for example, you mentioned Hizb Tahrir, they are given a no platform policy. Yeah, some people might disagree with their ideas, some people will agree with their ideas, but they're not violent, they're not advocating violence, they're not inciting the violence, and they want to discuss their ideas for intellectual purposes. Why not permit that? That's what it means to have freedom of speech, pursuit of truth, intellectual discussion and criticism. So some people tried to now ban all intellectual discourses, when intellectual discourses are not insult and should not be restricted and is actually a danger in a society. So I advocate for open, no holds barred intellectual discourse for the pursuit of truth. However, gratuitous insult and the incitement to violence or the incitement to discriminate or persecute a community, or which you see in a lot of sectarian discourse, I am completely against. And I think it's a workable system. It's a system that was applied in Islamic lands on many occasions. I mean, we weren't always consistent with that, but there were many occasions where this was applied. It is mandated by Islam, and I think it's something to let the West could actually learn from us. And that's basically my position.
Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum. Peace upon you all. Okay, so from my position, I think I've kind of been, you know, many of the points have been discussed already. So what I'm going to try and do is ignore what I had written here and just start thinking about things in a different way. Freedom of expression, one of the biggest problems that we actually have with freedom of expression is not, it is of course what's been talked about, but it's also about the double standards that are being used. That is actually the fundamental issue here. I am very, very happy if the British government and British society, me being a part of it, decides that this is where the line is drawn, because everyone agrees there is a line somewhere. I'm very happy with that. But what I really, really don't like is the double standards that are used. So you have, for example, the British government saying to everybody else in the world, freedom of expression, all this kind of thing, but when it actually comes to it, when they look at the way that the laws are in the UK, for example, as was mentioned earlier, the fact that insult is actually against the law in some respect. David Davis today in City AM was actually arguing against this, but it's there in the law. But when another country does it and is using it in a different way, it's something, there's a problem with it. Let me give a couple of examples to make it clear. Now, not that I agree or disagree with these, just to highlight these questions. We know that in Germany, for example, or in Austria, let's use Austria as an example, David Irving was put in prison for denying the Holocaust. It's a ridiculous thing for him to have done. But the question that happens, and the reason why he got that law, is because there's a specific sensitivity in Germany about the Holocaust. They were the people who did this stuff. They killed millions of Jews. You can understand where they're coming from. There is a reason for their curtailment of freedom of speech. So it's okay when a European country does it. When another country does it, but they have a different reason. Their cultural milieu, the way that they think within that other environment is different, that's not allowed. That's where the question is. It's this double standard. When you have, for example, freedom of speech being used as a political tool. You see these pussy riots in Russia. I'm not sure if you've seen that a lot of the Western media especially has been very, very harsh on the fact that the Russian government have put a couple of people in prison for 2 years, I think, for protesting in a cathedral. Now, whether or not I agree or disagree with that, we have in the UK the example of deterrence. One person might, you know, just go into a shop and steal one thing and be put in prison for 2 years. As an example, Russia might be doing that. As an example, the question is, when we see it, when we look at it from the Western perspective on others, we try and impose what we want as a political tool. And that is the problem. In the UK at this moment in time, or in many countries, they're banning things like Press TV. They're banning news organizations, which I may have huge issues with. Unbelievable issues with Press TV. I mean, I know people who work there. There are many issues with Press TV that one might have. But you have a situation where they're being banned. But then when a Muslim country or a different country decides to ban some media organization, there's a problem. This is we have to fundamentally, the double standards are the things that I personally really cannot understand or accept. We have so many situations where just recently when there was the movie, the film came out, right? What did France do? They actually banned, having said, oh, it was fine that this happened, they actually banned Muslims getting on the street and protesting against this because they thought it might result in violence or things like that. So they're against the freedom of assembly in that situation. It's this continuous double standards and the use of free speech as a political tool to silence those who are a minority, for to encourage some sort of thinking. Just look at it right now. Look at the way that in America the discourse is with when it comes to Muslims. And we talk very nicely, you know, about the fact that you know, we want to make sure that minorities are protected, and that's why you ban the fascists in the UK. Okay, let's look at another liberal democracy in America. What's happening there? The general discourse, the acceptability of Islamophobia is unbelievable. We have Said Awarsi in the UK, a conservative, and a known conservative, saying that Islamophobia has passed the dinner table test, where it's okay to start bashing Muslims in public. There is a big double standard in general when it comes to speech, free speech. When it comes to how you deal with Jews, when it comes to how you deal with Muslims, when as was mentioned earlier. And my fundamental question, in addition to what's been mentioned before, is this double standard. And that's something that we have to really, really work on. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Before I open up to anyone else, I'd like to open up to you. Do you have any comments, questions for each other? The points that you've raised?
I think one thing I would raise with the fascists on campus is that it's not so much that their ideas can be refuted when they come onto campus, because of course that can easily be done. I mean, I know you're planning on debating with Tommy Robinson, and I'm sure you're going to wipe the floor with him, because his ideas when he comes out there, they're not particularly well expressed, and you know he's not a very good debater at all.
If ever he comes out of jail.
But I think one of the issues with fascist groups coming onto campus is that it's not just the groups themselves that cause problems. It's that you often see a rise in attacks on minorities or the creation of an environment that is threatening to minorities. I mean, I'm only doing this from my personal experience of attending events where, in this particular case, I went to an event at Westminster University where a Hizb-ut-Tahrir speaker was on the platform, and a Jewish student stood up and asked him if he would condemn a statement that he'd printed off from the Hizb-ut-Tahrir website, which was essentially asking Allah to, you know, allow the Muslim armies to cleanse the earth of the Jews. It's from their old Bangladesh website, and the speaker refused to condemn it. And when the student identified that he was Jewish, he was booed out of the room by supporters of this guy who had just turned up, come to the debate specifically to be there to support the speaker from Hizb-ut-Tahrir. And so I do think that you have to worry that you might create an environment where that kind of thing is acceptable. You know, there were very few people there who were willing to stand up and protest against that kind of environment, because it was a very intimidating place to be at the time. So I mean, that's possibly where I come from on the extremist on campus thing. I'm not sure how you would respond to that, but that would be my point.
Can I go first then?
Sure.
Well, I just wanted to. So, exactly on that point, and my question is always on double standards. I'm going to just use that as my thing, because everyone else can deal with it. The question is, in a situation where an Israeli spokesperson comes up and says, we need to wipe the floor clean with all the Palestinians, and talks in that kind of language when it comes to the idea, and all of the hate speech that comes out. I mean, you can go and listen and read anything that Netanyahu's said or done in the past. I mean, there's so much there. There's so many people. If you were to start drawing a line, it has to be consistent. And that's my problem. The problem is that at this moment in time, Muslims are the bogeyman. Let's just use everything to hit the Muslims. And that's the problem that we... With this inconsistency, that sort of encourages this kind of spiral of hatred or anti-establishment thinking. And you see this with Babar Ahmad and Talha Ahsan recently with the extradition. You see this with everything. And it's the double standards which cause the problem as well. So there you go.
Sure. I mentioned a few points. Okay, firstly, everything that is, you know, is good and virtuous in life comes with a price tag. And one of these price tags, if you want to have open intellectual criticism, is that you're going to have some people who act idiotically. But generally, these people will do so in an environment of incitement to hatred. So basically, there's incitement or demonization. So these fascist groups, what they do is, just like the Nazi propaganda against Jews in Weimar Republic Germany, they would demonize society, say that they're a fifth column, say that they're out, you know, that the Muslims are out to get us, they're out to take over the world, take over our country, and so on and so forth. And that created a mass hysteria, which then led to some very highly deplorable violence against Jews. Now, that is the kind of speech which should not be on campus. But if someone wants to, just purely as an intellectual exercise, and in some cases, for example, I've heard of the Cambridge Union, they debate some very wacky, outlandish topics, and it's understood that in Cambridge Union you can debate anything. And I agree with that. That's a great idea. Even if you look in Islamic scholarship, you see all kinds of weird and wacky questions being discussed, which were completely out there. And so this is I don't see no problem with that. Incitement to hatred, there's a distinction between incitement to hatred, incitement to violence, and intellectual criticism on anything. Even if they wanted to, even if people want to discuss, does race indicate superiority of intelligence? All right, let that be debated in public, and hopefully they'll be refuted. Yeah, but it can only happen once they come into the light. Then the falsehood will vanish. Now, in terms of HT, I take it upon myself to know the facts about different Islamic groups in the Muslim world and things like this. And from what I've seen for many years of their publications, they've done publications on the history of the Muslims and relations with Jews, and they take pride in the fact that Jews were protected, Jews were looked after, Jews had lived in respectable environments where they could prosper, where taxes were light, where they had better treatment than Europe. So I saw publications that HG produced where they are basically extolling the virtues of Islamic civilization in how well it treats non-Muslims, yet you're telling me that they're now advocating the cleansing the earth of Jews. Now, I can't speak for this any obscure Bangladeshi articles that might be cited, but I've never seen any HT member advocate cleansing the world of Jews or anything like this. It's the first I've heard of it. Generally, where I hear that from is, I'm not saying that's yourself, but I'm saying that I hear Zionists generally try to libel or slander a lot of different Islamic groups because these Islamic groups advocate the return of Palestine to the indigenous inhabitants and a peaceful coexistence, not under domination of what was really a racial-based ideology, which is the elephant in the room here. What is Zionism? It's a racially-based ideology. And that is that not fascism? Is that not as we understand fascism to be? So I think there is double standards, as the brother was saying, that Zionism is permitted to be discussed on campus, which advocates a kind of a chosen fatherland or motherland or whatever for a racial group, a preeminence of this racial group within that land. Where have we heard these ideas before? And but other people who criticize that, who advocate justice for Palestinians, they're called extremists. They're lumped in the same basket as far-right fascists to demonize them. And I think that double standards is not acceptable.
Seems like double standards is working its way across the table.
Indeed. Now you have to use that term as well.
Okay. talking of double standards, I would certainly agree with some of the stuff that you've been saying. The idea of the protest ban on protest in France was particularly shocked by that. As by the hijab ban as well, which I think is another kind of double standard. You have your freedom of expression to look and dress how you want, but in France you're not allowed to wear a hijab, which to me seems, like I said, a double standard. I mean, in some of the other cases, less so. I mean, as far as I was aware, Press TV was banned in the UK for sort of repeatedly breaking Ofcom's guidelines on how a TV channel should act. And I mean, Ofcom are hardly the censors out to get everyone. I mean, they're actually fairly useless in most cases. So, I mean, I think possibly with Press TV, that's less of a double standard. And possibly the same with Holocaust denial as well. I think Holocaust denial so often comes with the cloaking of anti-Semitism and racial hatred. It's not just about not being able to say a particular historical event happened to me.
That's what David Irving did, though, right? That's exactly what David Irving did. He was discussing in university lectures about the historicity of the Holocaust, saying that he thought it didn't happen, and he came up with these sources. I don't know where he get these crazy ideas from, but he gets them, and he was discussing them in a theoretical intellectual environment.
No, true, but I think my point is that where you find sort of Holocaust denial, you often don't have to go much further to find.
And exactly, but then hate the anti-Semitism. As that's the thing that's wrong. Not the free speech. You see, the thing that matters is that, understandably, in the Western environment where we've been soiled by this absolute ridiculous, unbelievable crime that has occurred within our lands here in Europe, where we have done this, of 6 million people being, or however million people being killed, yes, that's something that's going to affect the Western mindset. That's understandable. The Eastern mindset, or the other mindset, whether it is in South America or throughout the whole world, they won't have the same thing when it comes to the Holocaust. They just don't. That's not something that they have any feeling towards. They do have feeling towards other things that they hold dear, that they have specific issues with. And what is very, very clear is that when there is a free speech curtailment for a specific reason, which is outside the normal scope of normal intellectual discourse, right? So for example, Holocaust or not, that is something that is specific to the culture that we have been brought up in, or in Germany and Austria specifically, that's very important. When it comes to the Eastern environments, it's the exact same thing. That is the biggest problem, right? When there is this double standard. And it's more than, Prestivia aside, using it as a political tool. Even if it's, for example, how America does pussy riots in those guys in Russia, let's go and talk about that. Bahrain, no, let's not talk about that. I mean, it's complete double standards. And the problem is that people see this, and it is that which is causing the biggest problem.
Do you not think that people possibly see, they see it as going further than it does do? So, for example, you mentioned the whole idea of the far right, or even just the Islamophobic discourse in the US, where obviously you have people like Pamela Geller and Robert Spencer who are causing sort of real issues there. But do you possibly think that people see the fact that they're allowed to speak, or even in the case of this publication of the Innocence of Muslims film, they see that and they think, well, that goes across the board, that feeling goes across the board, and they think, you know, how come the West is allowed to talk in those terms and we're not, when actually this is a very small minority of the West who are loathed by the vast majority. Now, as I said, it's kind of time for the sort of majority to kind of make clear that actually we don't want those guys, they're not part of our discourse. And I mean, there's this potential problem that people seem to think that just because one person is saying it, it seems to apply to everyone. And that kind of then creates this idea that the double standard is everywhere, whereas actually it is just a small minority of people getting involved.
Might I interject? I think, look at America. Obama goes out of his way to constantly repeat that he's not a Muslim. Why does that matter? Right? If you're trying to get votes from, if the majority of the American population, you know, aren't Islamophobic or they don't have this mentality, that's fine. But why is he going out of his way to say, no, I'm not a Muslim, please don't look at me, view me as a Muslim, and so on. So this is, I mean, the Ground Zero Mosque issue caused mass outrage. Rowan Williams, just discussion on voluntary arbitration courts, like Jews have in this country. That caused an absolute storm. People thought that, you know, Rowan Williams was going to start advocating beheadings next and all kinds of things, you know, and bring the Saudi Mutawa over. You know, so this is not the, you know, this is what we see. As Baroness Warsi said, the dinner table test. It's now acceptable. It's okay discourse. The Daily Mail, which ironically has a history of supporting the British Union of Fascists and the Nazis, is now targeting the Muslims. And as I said, Muslims are the new Jews of Europe. So, as I said, like this is the double standards. If you just replace the word Muslim in a lot of these discourses with the word Jew, everyone will instantly recognize it for what it is. But when, but because it's Muslim, oh, that's okay. It's just a religion. It's not a race, and so on. They use that defense, and then you see mosques being burnt. You see a very sad case in America of a Sikh gurdwara where 6 people were shot because the guy actually thought it was a Muslim. It was a Muslim mosque. So this is the kind of problems we see now. And just to kind of I think just hit home about the double standards. You see that young man Azhar Ahmed, who said that British soldiers should die and go to hell, right? An angry outburst, and he was, you know, convicted of that, and of basically making some kind of public offense, and he basically and the judge said, well, you know, okay, his sentiments were not necessarily illegitimate. It was, he could have worded it better. Oh, I'm sorry, he didn't word it better. You know, this is the kind of problem. And you see, again, you know, the guy who burned the poppies from Al-Mahajir, I mean, I totally disagree with Al-Mahajir's methodology, and, you know, a lot of their worldview, but burning poppies and taking coffins down Wootton Bassett, if you are going to be committed supporters of freedom of speech, should be permitted, right? But people will say, but that insults us, that offends us, that, you know, people in Britain, that the poppy represents many people who died in various, you know, world wars. And, you know, coffins through Wootton Bassett where, you know, the dead are taken through. It offends people. And I'm saying, okay, if we understand, if we can recognize human nature, that humans have things which are sacred that should not be insulted, then don't insult Islam. And don't treat your taboos as more important than our taboos if we believe in equality.
And just to add to that, I mean, from my personal view, I'm not necessarily of the same opinion that you have to have a law against insult. I don't mind. What I don't like is the fact that there is this double standard. That's the thing that I don't like. I don't mind, actually. If you want to have insult, then make sure it's insult equal to all. You know? Then that's fine. But I don't like the fact that one group is given a specific bad name, especially in the current environment. I mean, I was in Ireland working, and I was in a taxi cab, and I was talking to the guy. I was just randomly talking, and he was talking about how is it? He looked at my face and he saw brown beard. You know, you have clearly some sort of problems at airports. And I was like, well, yes, I did in America, but here in Ireland, it's not really a problem. He was like, yeah, you know what? Me as an Irishman. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when I was coming to Britain, oh my God, you should see the kinds of stuff that used to happen to me. You guys are like now the new Irish. I was like, oh, that's nice. Oh, thanks. And I felt really, I felt happy that he faced kind of issues in the past. And you see, this is the problem. The problem is double standards. And it's nice that everyone else is agreeing with me.
I wanted to raise one point with Abdullah, is that you were mentioning... If you want to have an intellectual debate on campus, then that's okay because it's based on a kind of intellectual setting and so on. So if somebody does want to propagate something like fascism, purely in an intellectual setting, my potential issue with that is that given today's environment, maybe that is possible and that can happen in Cambridge Union and so on, but given the kind of environment that we have, do you think that's a practical way of doing it? I mean, are we actually at a stage where we can do that, or is it the case of, okay, let's keep a lid on it rather than opening the door and letting it happen and then potentially leading to other issues?
Some people could say it is context dependent. So let's say if in the future the West has moved past its time-honored tradition of demonizing every single outsider that comes in, outside community at some point in the other, and Muslims are no longer the object of vilification. To have fascists come in, maybe Tommy Robinson's grandson come in and talk about how Muslims were going to take over the world. And still might, he should have that right to intellectually discuss that, but maybe in an environment where there's obviously a lot of demonization of Muslims, where there is a kind of a very palpable atmosphere where violence is going to happen or will happen against Muslims, like what happened against Jews in the past, then that wouldn't be so wise. But it does depend how you do it. I mean, for example, my organization, Muslim Debate Initiative, as our name suggests, we do debates. We tried to invite Tommy Robinson to do a debate on his issues with Islam. And that's only because no one was challenging him. I mean, he would wax lyrical about how the Quran says this, the Quran says that. But no one's ever challenged him. Paxman just gave him a free ride, in my opinion. And I thought, okay, I think someone should challenge him on these ideas and give it a public airing and let the public decide. Because that needed to happen. But certain groups thought that you shouldn't give a platform to fascists, even though it would have hopefully had a beneficial outcome. It was going to be a fair debate, but hopefully it would have had a beneficial outcome. But they didn't allow it. And, we are trying to, at the moment, try to reorganize that debate for another time when Tommy Robinson comes out of jail at some point. But, there are times where it is beneficial to have intellectual discourse. You can't just ignore an idea that's spreading through society and hope it'll go away because, the Sun and the Daily Mail, they regularly radicalize, thousands, even millions of people. And there's no voice... That's countering. So there's also, you have to look at the other context wherein Islamophobia is loudly broadcast throughout all channels in the media and in loads of pundits, even those who are just sympathetic but not necessarily outwardly aggressive and hostile. and there is no counter voice. So in this situation now, it is prudent for us to actually debate these far right fascists, because that no one's actually hearing our voice. So we're the marginalized voice. So even if it means debating these fascists, we should do so to get our voice heard.
I disagree slightly on the EDL sense. I mean, the public have widely rejected the EDL. I mean, when they attempted to demonstrate in Walthamstow, and they were made to look fools, essentially, because so many people from the local area turned out to say, you are not welcome here, we do not support your ideas. And I think that's a great sign, the fact that even, you know, these people, they don't need to have a platform, you know, on TV to explain their ideas and have them debunked, because people know that their ideas are you know, ludicrous and do not, you know, not conducive to a good society. I personally thought Paxman actually made Tommy Robinson look like an idiot when he went on Newsnight. I'd slightly disagree on that. I mean, I'd be keen to know which kind of commentators you'd say are sort of outwardly Islamophobic on TV. Because, I mean, I think one of the good things about the UK, actually, is that we have a fairly balanced media, I mean, in a lot of senses. I mean, I work with people who are both, on the right wing of the Conservative Party, who are sort of, you know, quite supportive of Israel, you know, very anti-Europe. And then I also know through personal collections a lot of people who work for Unite or Unison or, you know, members of Young Labour, and they both think the BBC is biased in favour of the other one, which to me suggests it's probably somewhere in the middle. So in that sense, I'd say that's possibly slightly misleading as well, to suggest that the media in this country are out there to demonise Muslims. I'm not a huge fan of the Daily Mail, and I agree that they do push the envelope on occasion. But I'd say on the whole, I think we are quite lucky to have the media that we have in this country.
I think that from a BBC perspective, whether or not I agree to be neutral on the side, that is an institution that, broad brush speak, it's pretty good. I mean, we're very, very, we should be proud that we have an institution like the BBC compared to America. There's no doubt. When it comes to broadcast media, we have something, even Ofcom, some of the stuff that it does, it's fine. But when it comes to actual print media, it's just completely and utterly different. Islamophobia is just rampant within the print media. The Sun, you almost could, if you had 3 days in a row, okay, ignoring sort of some sort of celebrity outbreak, you're going to have some Islamophobia or immigrant or some equivalent type speak coming up. And there'll always be something that's used. It might not be direct, this Muslim did this, but it's always in that kind of, some sort of equivalent language, and it's always this sort of undercurrent of Islamophobia which is being pushed within the sort of print media, especially within some of the sort of Sun male type argument and discourse. It's just unbelievable. You can, even when it comes up to things like Barbara Rahman and Talas, and more recently the way that it's reported, and this was even in the Guardian, for God's sake, the lefty of the lefty papers, right? You see that the picture on the front is who? This hook-handed guy who has one eye. Now, for other than the fact that he was doing that to get rid of mines in Afghanistan, which is actually quite a nice thing to do, ignoring that, what is he? He's an immigrant, he's a Muslim, he's brown, he's got a beard, he's on benefits. I mean, what more do you need? This is the kind of poster boy for ignoring the fact that there are other people where there is a legitimate discussion. This is the stuff that's used. So I fundamentally disagree with the idea that the media is unbiased here in the UK. I think it's better than in America and many other countries, and specifically when it comes to broadcast media. But when it comes to print media, no way, not even close.
Basically, you're right. There are some, you know, good newspapers which have some balance, and them, you know, perhaps the Guardian, the Times, and there's some great newspapers out there, and that's fine. I'm not saying all the media is some big conspiracy. No, I'm saying that sensationalism sells. It's a basic market principle. And it's a reckless principle, because sensationalism can lead to civil strife when you're when a white man who's a paedophile is just a paedophile, a Muslim who's a paedophile is a rape gang, or, you know, and so on. And they found paedophile gang. I mean, there was even, like, I think, was it 1 or 2 years ago, they found close to, I think, what was it, 1,700 paedophiles in a police sting within the UK. And, you know, that's an amazing number, astronomical number. But they find, you know, okay, 50 or 60 or so paedophiles amongst the Muslim community, and that is an absolute sensation, outrage, and so on and so forth. Even though, by quantity, finding 1,700 or so paedophiles is mind-blowingly big. So why is that disproportionate reporting? I mean, if I got my magazines right, I mean, you get, for example, Spectator magazine, you get Douglas Murray, you get Melanie Phillips, and you get a whole host of other pundits who basically make a living off Islam bashing, and within the UK. Now, to name but a few, but they're not controversial figures within the society. They're not viewed with disdain. I mean, obviously you get interfactional fighting between conservatives and liberals and so on. That's normal. But generally speaking, it's not. These people are known, they are respected, they have widely known profiles. There is no PC ostracism of them. And what they're saying is not even contested. So basically, when anyone says about Muslims, saying that, oh, Islam is a violent faith and Muslims are violent, what they'll say is, no, Muslims are integrating within society. But no one will question the idea whether Islam is actually a violent faith or not. They'll just say, yes, of course, it's one of these medieval religions, it must be. But Muslims, we shouldn't tar Muslims with the same brush. And what I object to is this now is it's taken as a given that Islam is a violent faith. So even liberals will not question this, will not challenge the idea, will not defend the Islamic belief on this issue. And they'll just say, no, but yes, while that might be true, Muslims are generally peace-loving people who, the implication is, they don't follow their faith properly. That's why they're not violent. That's why they're peaceful. And this is the kind of thing I dislike. And this is why I try, in my small capacity, to actually kind of nip it in the bud, this kind of discourse, and say, look, Islam isn't a violent faith. It is pluralistic and inclusive. It has been misunderstood for a number of reasons. But I think it is widely accepted now, this Islamophobic narrative, as I said, past the dinner table test. And I think just lastly, the EDO issue. The EDL have been obviously rejected by most society currently, although a lot of people don't know about them, and I think about 66% of people, two-thirds of people, don't know about them or what they represent, right? However, they hate the EDL because they think they're racist, the EDL are racist. Now, I think they have racial-based politics, if you dig deeper, but on the ground, from what I've been, my discourse and my kind of checking with people who are just the average Joe Bloggs on the street, who doesn't know much about these things, they say, well, I was told to hate the EDL, but when I listen to EDL, they have a point. They don't say they're racist. They don't say that they are against different racial groups. They just say they're against militant Islam and against violent faiths, and that seems like a fair comment. So while they're not supported because people think that they are racist, which I argue that they are, people find what they say to be acceptable because the EDL have couched their racism in a language which they know kind of fits into the mainstream, which is, i.e., Islam has problems in Western society and is problematic, and Muslims, are a problem. And I think that this is where the EDL will get their acceptance, and it's only a matter of time before the often touted refrain against them, which is they're racist, will cease having any purchase, and they will kind of gain more credibility.
Can I just add to that? Completely agree with Rolat, but I'm actually trying to add that in terms of like the broadcast media, in terms of the Islamophobic aspect which they have, I think they're very professional about it, and although they're not direct about it, but they are essentially Islamophobic, in that showing and portraying the side of Muslims which would give an impression that Muslims are terrorists, Muslims are all radical kind of knuckles. Like just take a simple example, like you'd never find moderate people being given a chance, moderate Muslims, whether they're imams of mosques or intellectual Muslims, being given a chance, very rarely, let's say, be given a chance to speak their views and speak their words and give like a true meaning of Islam. You'd always find people like who are like enlarged and shown on the media, people like Anjem Chowdhury, who's like in the media all the time, even though him and his group, they're like, if you look at when they burned the poppy, I remember seeing it in the newspapers, the picture. There's probably about 10, 20 of them, and most of them are little kids, most of them are like teenagers, and they're there burning a poppy. And now compared it to like, I don't know, a million or 2 million Muslims in Britain, yeah, that's so exponentialized and shown on the media, and it just literally gives an impression that, yeah, that's how they all are. People like Abu Hamza, again, they're always given a chance on TV. He was born hard talk, and he was like, he's always, people like Al-Bakri, there. You know, he was invited over to the BBC a few times. Even though, I mean, it's not, from my personal experience, I know like one imam of a mosque who used to contact BBC many times and, you know, offer them that he's willing to come and talk, and they'll reject him and they'll bring al-Bakri instead. So it's kind of like that. I mean, like you said, I mean, if you want to talk about extremist Muslims, okay, fine, there might be some extremist Muslims, but there's extremist Christians, there's some radical Christians, you know, who can like talk about stuff that they've done. There's radical Jews, there's radical Hindus, there's radical everyone. There's radical atheists, there's always nutcases, let's say, who've got extreme views, or who preach violence, or are violent people in nature. And Muslims, you know, they don't have a high proportion. They don't have a high proportion of them. You know, Islam is generally a peaceful religion, and Muslims are generally peaceful people. They're generally very successful. You know, they're not. You know, they contribute a lot to society. There's, you know,
the kind of point you're trying to make is that Muslims are kind of targeted more than everyone.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's a twisted picture of them, which is shown in a very professional way.
What do you think about that? I mean, do you think that that's the case? Is that what's happening? I mean, Rupert, you raised the point that the media is quite fairly balanced, but that's it. Well, not really. And based on that, what do you think about that point?
I mean, I would say there's definitely a problem, potentially, of getting the most controversial speaker that you can get. But I think that's often done on many topics. I mean, it's unfortunate in the case here that they do happen to get people like, or they used to get people like Omar Bakri or someone like that. I mean, they're much better now, I think, than they used to be a few years ago, especially a couple of years after 9/11. It was always kind of, you know, Omar Bakri or someone before he, you know, stupidly went on holiday and then wasn't allowed back in. I think they're better than they are now. And I mean, to be honest, where I work, we kind of work against that. Like if we find the BBC have been promoting people like that, we will often write, or in fact, every time we write to them and say, look, this is the person you're promoting, this is the kind of thing they've said in the past, like these are not representative of the Muslim community, or, you know, these are not guys who should be given a voice. I mean, I've noticed that it has become less common recently. I mean, I don't think it's that common to start with anyway. You don't often see someone like that. I mean, look at, for example, someone like Mehdi Hassan, who I personally disagree with on certain issues, but no one could accuse him of being an extremist. I mean, I don't think he is. You know, I wouldn't call him an extremist, and he's, you know, he's very regularly on the media, or someone like you know, Miriam Francois Serra, or someone like that. You know, there are, you know, moderate Muslims, and you know, people out there who do get given the opportunity to go on. And I mean, I agree with you. I think, like you said, sensationalism sells in some cases, and people will think, you know, who can I get as the most controversial thing? But I would be wary of calling that institutionalized sort of Islamophobia or institutionalized racism. I think that's possibly just more sort of institutionalized let's get a story, or, you know, institutionalized sensationalism more than that.
Institutionalized capitalism, probably.
Okay. I think we'll open up to a few questions from the audience. So.
Thank you, that was really good so far. Do you think all of this shows that religion is becoming too politicized? That even within the same religion, each person will believe something different? And having politics and religion mixing does lead to people using religion as an excuse for a political movement. So, for example, people are doing, blowing themselves up in the name of Islam or whatever, and it puts Islam in that frame of mind, and it's encouraging people to do things for and against it, and it's just creating conflict in between communities and highlighting their differences, when really it's not actually that necessary, because religion is such a personal thing that it doesn't need to be part of the government or part of politics.
Okay, I think the problem is that in politics in general, you're always going to try and identify or represent certain views. And if there are a group of people who have certain views, and that is shared partially because of religion, then it is not unlikely that some people will try and represent those views in some way. And that the fact that there is politics and Islam mixing, there are pros and cons to it. So there's a pro that you need to have that kind of representation. And some might argue, okay, let's have it in a secular perspective. You know, you can have a British Muslim conservative, British Muslim liberal, you can have someone in between. You can argue it on that perspective as well. But the sort of counter argument is that you kind of want that, you kind of want that sort of proportional representation in there in some regard. You want to make sure that there is representation for that kind of thinking. So that's on the one side. On the other hand, the problem with saying that you want to get rid of this sort of link with politics and religion, other than what I've just said right now, is that for some people, it is their view that they should be together. And it's very difficult to say. We've been talking about freedom of speech. There are quite a lot of people who just think that, you know, Islam is the way of life for me and it should be the way of life for others. And it's very, very difficult to say they don't have a right to have that view. It's very, very difficult to argue on that regard. You know, we're saying let them have that view, let that be fought out in the open space of ideas, and let them lose or win that idea and that argument.
I'm saying how it highlights the difference between the communities.
But that's standard. I mean, the discussion between the sort of difference between ideas is what leads to innovation and development.
But I think it also leads to sensitivities and conflict. And I think that, for example, what you were saying about intellectual discourse and inciting violence really isn't the only difference, the reaction. If someone said to me, and this has happened to me a lot of times, that wearing hijab they think is really weird and they don't see the point of it, I could get offended by it because I've seen many people that have get offended by it, but really I just say, well, actually, no, this is why I wear it, and I respond in an intellectual way. So by having, say, for example, what you're saying about things in media always having Islamophobic comments, it's highlighting differences between communities to making things very heated. And then when you do get someone saying something, either just a stupid comment that incites violence or whatever, it just creates conflict when it could have just been an intellectual discussion if it wasn't such a big topic.
Sure. Just to answer that, well, basically, you judge it by the intent. Right, you always have to judge things by the intent, and it's common sense when you know someone is saying something to you to insult you, and when someone's saying something to you to initiate a debate or discussion. I don't think getting a pineapple and putting a label on it saying Muhammad is, I'm just insulting discussion. You know, that's not how you create discussion on it. That's obviously an insult, ridicule, and some of these, you know, new atheists use ridicule as their main weapon in lieu of any intellectual substance. But that's their method of things. I disagree with that, and I think that kind of that insult is, I mean, it's not a grave insult, but it certainly is as in, you know, it was just students. They didn't, you know, but. It's an insult which I dislike. Obviously, having as a Muslim, I love the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. But there is a difference between intellectual discourse and actual inciting to violence or demonizing or dehumanizing a people based on their beliefs. Saying that somehow they're immoral, somehow they're a fifth column, somehow they are a clear and present danger to our society. This incites people to discriminate against that group of people, to treat them as less than human or less than deserving of respect. And this is where I take contention with that. In regards to your earlier comment about religion being politicized, this is a kind of an anachronism. Religion was politics for most of human history. If you look at any religion, from the word for Hinduism is not Hinduism; it's the Dharma. Dharma is law. You know, the Halakha for the Jews, it is their law. For example, you know, Eightfold Path, it is a law for a lot of various Buddhists. So it was a law system. Sharia is a law. So it is a modern day idea to look at religion, that anyone that talks about religion in a political way, as being you're mixing religion and politics. You can't mix something with itself. They are one and the same thing. I mean, how can you separate your viewpoint for the reason for human existence, your viewpoint to humans from human life's affairs? You can't detach, you know, the purpose of life from life's affairs.
No, I think you can. I think personally, for me, I think that basic ethics for me correlates with Islamic ethics, and I think that coming from an Islamic perspective and coming from an ethical perspective are two, they're one and the same, but they're two different perspectives. And I think that if I'm having a discussion or interacting with non-Muslims, I don't need to come from an Islamic perspective to come from an ethical perspective.
Well, if you're saying that, we can adopt, let's say for example, liberal ethics because it corresponds with Islamic ethics, you're already affirming that Islam has ethics which are political. So that means Islam already has something to say about the political aspect. And all I'm saying is then, as a Muslim, you don't need to go outside, if Islam is complete and actually deals with human affairs and life, then you don't need to go outside it to seek solutions, if you adopt Islam as your viewpoint to life. If you don't, then obviously you can go outside as you wish. So this is, again, this is a different discussion as to Islam, liberalism, and other ideologies or religions. But there is a fundamental difference, between liberal ethics and Islamic ethics. But what I try to advocate is where they can either intersect, because generally speaking, humans, we all believe that murder is wrong, for example. So these are intersections that we can obviously agree with and have some kind of civilized way to live together. And obviously, the Sharia does affirm that when you're in a country. When you enter into a country or you live in the country, that you abide by the laws under a covenant of peace and security. So that means that basically, as Muslims, we can live within England in peace and security and be good citizens. Not because it's a civic duty, and not because I want to honor the flag or any other pretensions to patriotism, but rather because Islam mandates that we should be good citizens and we should be good neighbors, and we should be good neighbors and kind and caring to anyone wherever we are, whether we're in Barbados or Madagascar. But Barbados is probably a better climate. But yes, so this is what Islam says. So when I'm advocating free discourse, but not insult, this is actually an Islamic perspective. And all I'm doing is I'm going to various Western legal theorists, so to speak, and saying, well, look, wouldn't this, knowing that what we know of human nature, wouldn't this solution work better for you? And English law, being thanks to Edmund Burke, is very pragmatic as well. It looked at human nature and didn't just go off with the fairies and apply, full-blown liberalism, which is too idealistic, and I my belief doesn't fit human nature. But Edmund Burke, thanks to him, we have a system that actually understands that, wait a second, if you incite hatred and against communities, violence will occur. There is a correlation. You can't have absolute freedom of speech. You see, whereas in true liberalism, would advocate, yes, ideas is an idea, expressing of an idea is not actually doing a physical action of harm against someone else. But we see a correlation, and the British law sees a correlation, Edmund Burke sees a correlation, and so now I can advocate, say, look, Islam says this, and do you not as well see the wisdom in this? Maybe you could apply this kind of distinction to help your society. And as Muslims, we should always be ambassadors to Islam and to solutions that will help humanity. So that's kind of my take. And I think that the last point is, you said people are killing in the name of Islam. No, people are killing in the name of revenge, pretty much.
But they're calling it Islam, which is what...
No, they're calling it revenge. If you look at... I forgot the name of the writer of this book. It's a book called The Statements of Osama bin Laden. This Western scholar... British scholar, rather, he basically went to look at all the statements of Osama bin Laden that he could authenticate and build up a kind of like a hadith collection of Osama bin Laden's statements. And he discovered that basically Osama bin Laden is not advocating this war against the West because the West is liberal or the West believes in freedom. He just woke up one day and said, hey, you know what, the West is free, I'll fight them. No, he said, fight them as they fight us. So they bomb our civilians, we bomb their civilians. This is obviously completely against Islam. We shouldn't act... We should be better than those who fight against us. We should always hold ourselves to a higher degree. If they bomb our civilians, we shouldn't retaliate. You know, two wrongs don't make a right and all that. But Osama believes you can get revenge. And he says it openly. And when one reporter asked him as to... doesn't it say in the Quran that you can't kill women and children? He responded quite funnily, but the law's not set in stone. Which reminds me of modernist discourse amongst modernist Muslims, basically, who can reinterpret Islam to fit the current context or age. I don't believe in that. I do believe the rules are set in stone. You can't kill women and children in any situation. You can't deliberately target them. He is wrong. And I think that should be made clear. It's not Islam. He doesn't even say it's Islam. He just says it's revenge because they kill Muslims. And the only thing he says about Islam is that he tells Muslims that as Muslims we should have concern for our fellow Muslims around the world and we should defend them. That's where he brings Islam. When it comes to the issue of revenge, he uses more secular language. So I think we've misrepresented him. I completely disagree with him. I think he's been a blight upon, you know, Muslim non-Muslim relations in globally. But we have to be objective about these things to understand and not just adopt the discourse of those who are perhaps sometimes you know, supporting attacks in Muslim lands. And how they pigeonhole us into, no, you're doing this in the name of Islam. No, they're doing it in the name of revenge. And you understand that, as you understand that concept as well.
I wonder if I could just jump in on that. I mean, I would completely agree with you when you said, obviously, that Islam is not a violent religion. And I mean, the idea that there seems to be that you have the sort of the West kind of sees Islam as a violent religion, I think is a kind of regrettable one, actually, because I mean I don't know anyone who thinks that Islam is violent. I mean, I could just be lucky in that sense, but I mean, I think if you take that on to the whole sort of religion being politicized thing, I mean, go kind of off message, I suppose, slightly a little bit here and talk about some of my personal views more. I think you have to kind of see that when people talk about religion and politics together, you're talking more about power than religion. And I think in a lot of cases the religious trappings that kind of conflict is cloaked in is more about achieving power than it is about being a good Muslim or fulfilling you know, Islam or something like that. So for example, I remember when I was chatting to these students on Tuesday, you know, a guy kind of stood up, a white guy stood up and said, you know, this is in the Quran, you know, the Taliban, they know the Quran back to front and they're doing these awful things. And I was, you know, trying to explain to him that the Taliban just want to get back into power. You know, they're not trying to be good Muslims or anything. So I think you have to be careful about kind of conflating sort of religion and politics in that sense. I mean, another thing with the whole bin Laden thing that you brought up, the fact that when what I suppose would now be referred to as Al-Qaeda was first formed in the 1980s, it was formed really of a lot of guys from different countries who headed to Afghanistan to fight the Russians. You know, they came. A lot of them came from previous militant groups who'd been fighting their own rulers in their countries. So, for example, the current leader of Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is an Egyptian who used to be the head of Egyptian Islamic Jihad. And when he first came over to Afghanistan, along with people like Abdullah Azam, who's a Palestinian militant who, you know, was keen on fighting the Israelis, they kind of moved away from this idea that religion, you know, their fight was against their own personal dictators, and that actually their fight should be against the West, because the West helped their dictators, or in their perception, the West helped their dictators. So even then, the conflict, even with, you know, the sort of archetypical religious terrorists, you know, people would always see bin Laden and Al-Qaeda as sort of religious terrorists, even then, the ultimate aim was still one of power. You know, these guys wanted to overthrow their individual dictators or their individual heads of state and gain power. And then they decided, when they came, you know, as their kind of group evolved over the course of the conflict, that actually what was stopping that from happening was the US support for their individual dictators. And they just refocused their fight against who they perceived to be the supporter of their group. So even then, they weren't fighting specifically, I don't think, personally, for revenge, although revenge, as you say, does come up a lot in bin Laden's statements. It was as much, if we are to overthrow our own dictators and gain political power, we will have to, you know, make sure the West cannot interfere in our ideas anymore. So I think you have to be a bit careful, like I said, when you conflate the two. So I hope that's a little bit, a sort of, you know, it makes it a bit clearer.
Okay. Open up to the audience a bit more. Anybody?
Yeah, just to jump onto what Abdullah was saying, Rupert, as well. Just like to pose a different question. Do you not think that Islam itself, or actually say Muslims, are the problem? You know, we're really quick to start blaming the Western government, the Western powers, that, you know, freedom of speech, the double standards that exist at the moment. But within Islam itself, the double standards which exist today. So, for example, you were talking about, at the time of the Prophet, intellectual debate was, you know, it was promoted as something that Islam was established on, which is perfectly true. But today, if you go and look at the modern Islamic world, debate is sort of thrown out the window. There are certain factions in Islam which don't want to, you know, come up for discussion. They promote intolerance, they breed intolerance, and you can see this around. You just have to go onto YouTube and type in the word Shia, and you will see that, you know, how much hatred is being incited within Islam, within the sect itself. If we look at, for example, Pakistan, the intolerance which stems from certain factions in Islam, they're killing each other just because basically you don't conform to my beliefs. Now, if we live in a religion, if we live in a time where our religion itself is, you know, has double standards where we cannot actually conform to what we say. So, you know, we're standing up over there protesting against the clear double standards which are present against us. but at the same time in the Middle Eastern countries, for example, with Saudi Arabia, what kind of, you know, they're not very tolerant, are they? They, for example, not freedom to speak, but when you're talking about actions, you know, women are not allowed to drive, which that's not really a modern day, there's nothing in Islam which sort of prohibits that. It's for, if we live in a time where Muslims themselves cannot unite, if we talk about the power ban in France, for example, all it would have taken was a few Muslim countries to stand up and show some dialogue with the French government to prove that, you know what, this is a basic human right, it's not going against the fundamentals of anything, it's not a security risk, it's just a piece of puzzle on space, it's a religious thing, let them accept it. If a few Muslim countries could have just stood up, gone into dialogue with the government, the issue could have been, the outcome could have been resolved, it could have been completely different. But when Muslim countries themselves are fighting against each other, when factions in Islam are fighting against each other, do you not think it's expected that Western governments and powers that, you know, Islamophobia does exist, so people that are promoting Islamophobia are going to pick up on this and use this against us? Shouldn't we fix the problem within Islam itself first before we come out and start blaming others for an issue that we've created?
Okay, from my perspective, I see myself as a British citizen. So I feel every right to say Britain's not doing something right. Nobody should, if anybody was to say that I don't have that right because I'm a Muslim as well, so I have to talk about Muslims, I think they're talking a lot of crap. I mean, I'm an equal citizen to the random white guy on the street or the random brown guy or whoever it is. And I have every right to say that I think Britain is doing something wrong. I also happen to also believe that Britain happens to be one of the most Islamic countries out there as well. I actually think that half of the, you know, the way that the health system works, or the way that we care for those who are less fortunate in society, there's so many things that I would consider to be very Islamic principles which Britain does far better than any Muslim country by a long shot. Now, just because I happen to be proud to be a British Muslim in many regards, I'm British, and I have every single right to focus on where I am right now and say, look, I'm here, I have an ability to influence my government through lobbying, through political movement, through voting for my MP, through letters, through a whole range of different means, some of which don't really work nowadays as well as you'd like. But I have every right to do that. So I don't think it is a fair thing to say that just because I'm a Muslim, I have to fix the problem with Muslims before I fix the problem here with Britain. I agree, however, that we can't ignore this issue. We should talk about it very much so, as long as it's not seen as a double standard where you have to talk about one and not talk about the other. All I'm saying is that being British means that I have every right to talk about Britain. And yes, I'm Muslim, and I should and talk about how Muslims as well, but I don't necessarily have that. I may not, for example, have that much affinity to some of the craziness happening in Pakistan at the moment. Right? I happen to have a Pakistani friend who does have that strength of unity with the people in Pakistan in that regard.
I was going to say, basically, so for example, I'd say pretty much that, you know, Britain to an extent is a fairly tolerant country, you know, it's given us quite a lot of freedoms, and we should be thankful for that.
Yeah.
But to an extent, the problem is that you see in Western media and a lot of the image that's been portrayed about Islam is our own doing. For example, the Innocence of Muhammad, the movie that was released, when it was originally released, there was no hype about it whatsoever, no one picked up on it, no one cared. It was used as a political tool, basically, to create an uprising, but we didn't do ourselves any favours. But at the same time, if we were to go on YouTube, you can find countless videos, countless documentaries, you know, promoting hatred against the Western governments, against Western people, against people who don't normally hold Islamophobic ideas, but just because, you know, because they're American, you know, we should
hate them. Yeah, hatred, the problem is hatred sells. Hatred is easy to talk about. Hatred is something that is very, very, very easy to get everyone behind some sort of bandwagon. Right? It's very, very hard to do the exact opposite. It's very, very hard to get a whole group of students together and say, we love Britain and we think it's it does great for the NHS. I mean, nobody's going to stand up and go to a protest about that, are they? That's just not going to happen. And because that's not going to happen, the people who stand up and shout the loudest are the ones who are going to get heard. And who shouts and stands up the loudest? Those who talk all this hate. That's always the case in everything. Whether it's to do with the EDL here in the UK or whether it's to do with the Muslims in the Muslims who stand up and talk about love and Sufism and all this kind of airy-fairy interesting stuff, that's fine, but they don't stand up and say it and they won't get that statement in public.
And the biggest problem is that the people that stand up and preach hate, especially from the Islamic point of view, they're growing in numbers. It's not a small population of Islam of Muslims that promote this viewpoint. It's something that's it's not recent. It's been there for quite a while, but the movement has grown tremendously. As in, nothing is excluded. University campuses themselves, you just have to step out and go outside. You find someone who has that point, who has that viewpoint, and it's being I'd say it's being forced upon other Muslims. For example, mosques that I used to visit previously, regardless of what sect they are. Nowadays, if you were to walk in just because I'm a Shia, you know, I'll be having nothing up to funny looks. They'll most likely kick me out. If I can't see tolerance within my own people, you can't really stand up and say that, you know what, you're the lot are being intolerant to us when it's completely hypocritical. I'm not saying we shouldn't have a right to complain or protest against what's happening against Muslims in general, but when we within ourselves cannot show each other any respect, and I'm not just generalising, it happens, as in everybody knows about it, it's a bit hypocritical for us to stand up and say that, you know what, these people are attacking us from, you know, the newspapers. I'm not disagreeing that it's not happening, it is definitely happening, but the biggest problem that I see is that within Islam itself, we are attacking each other, and unless you solve that problem, the quote is famous that, you know, Muslims are arguing whether they're to pray with their hands down or together while the enemy is trying to chop our hands off. And the quote is basically timeless because it explains all the problems that we are seeing today. And regardless of the debate on freedom of speech is very important, and it's something that needs to be talked about, but there's no freedom of speech within Islam itself. What it used to be at the time of the Prophet, but in today's Islam, it's not Islam that's the problem, it's the Muslims. And if we aren't going to address that, people are going to pick up on the issue and they're going to exploit it. And that's what happened. For example, Al-Qaeda themselves, you know, they're not Muslims. Rupert over there basically said they're just out to get power. And if you were to look at their leaders, they drink alcohol, they don't follow the laws of Islam. There's no Islam there whatsoever, but that's what's been portrayed as Islam. And if we're going to, you know, if you don't stand up and speak out against that, how many people do you see protesting? How many Muslims do you see protesting against Al-Qaeda? You're never going to see that. There's never been a protest saying that, you know, what is the Al-Qaeda forces have gone around killing innocent people, let alone the armed forces from the European governments. They've been killing innocent Muslims. We don't protest against that, do we? We were ready to protest against the war in Afghanistan, but what about the people within Afghanistan who are killing the Afghanistani citizens? You know, there were people dying before the governments went inside. It's not only the European governments that have created this problem. I'm not saying they're not to blame as well, but, you know, we do hold a hand in this problem.
Sure. I mean, a lot of what you said is true, and it is very regrettable. I mean, okay, I think that there are just a few points. I mean, a lot of these groups who do violence against innocent civilians, both Muslim and non-Muslim, they are desiring of power. They are looking to get power. I was referring to their statements. Their statements don't say, "Hey, we're out to get power." They try to couch in, "We're doing revenge." But my point was that they don't say, "We're doing this in the name of Islam," to killing civilians. No, they say, "We're doing it in revenge." So they kill our civilians, we kill their civilians. I just wanted, because people always say that they quote Quranic verses to support what they're doing, or terrorism is an interpretation of Islam. And I say it's not, because the people themselves who do the terrorism don't say, "I'm doing this because the Quran says here, here." Doesn't say that. They don't do that. They just say, "We're getting revenge because they don't play by the rules. We won't play by the rules either." That's in essence what they say. So,
there are people that are there to seek revenge, guaranteed, I'm not disagreeing with that, but there's also people out there that say that, you know what, these are disbelievers, they're far from this point of view, they'll legitimize the reason that, you know, you're non-believers,
yeah.
And so...
I tell you, but you see, here's the thing, all right? Okay, so say a faction of Muslims or a sect of Muslims, they say, are non-Muslim. But what does Islam say you treat non-Muslims as? You don't start bombing their... All right, fine. Okay, so let's say one faction of Muslims are equivalent to Christians and Jews. What do you do with them? Well, you coexist peacefully with them. You see, you don't blow up churches, you don't blow up synagogues, you don't blow up the temples of Majus, and by extension, some people say, you know, obviously the Hindu temple as well. If Muslims don't do that to non-Muslims, then why are these people doing it to those who they say are non-Muslim, but regardless of whether they're Muslim or not, you don't do that to non-Muslims. So the reason why they're doing it has got nothing to do with an interpretation of Islam at all. Obviously, if they really did think that one sect is non-Muslim, they would treat them as non-Muslims, but they don't. So what you are seeing is the same thing you're seeing in Rwanda, in Guatemala, in Bosnia. It's sectarianism. Generally arises in democratic countries. Sectarianism is democracy is wanting to when you start establish it creates sectarians who fight for power in that society. I mean, look at Iraq, for example, completely split up. Funnily enough, you know, before this liberation of democracy, they actually were more united. Okay, under obviously a terrible dictator, but no different than any other Arabic dictator in the region. Anyway, so it's this problem of factionalism amongst Muslims. It's indicative of a very kind of declined thinking. It's a whole sociological discussion there as to how 500 years of intellectual atrophy has led to basically Muslims not even understanding cause and effect in politics. You see, believing in conspiracy theories that the Freemasons or the Jews control the world, all that rubbish, right? And I am still debating with Muslims, you know, who say, oh, but you see the evidence, and to give evidence that is literally impossible to disprove. What I mean by that is you can't disprove a conspiracy theory. If I want to say that the world is run by shape-shifting lizards, yeah, and when someone dies, they replace it with a human cadaver, or, you know, that they've molded to look like the person that there's meant to be, and they say, oh, look, you know, the autopsy shows they were human. That means that they were probably a shape-shifting lizard who replaced it with... You literally, there's no way to refute it. You can't. They can invent any way, any explanation to justify it. So that's unfortunately an affliction, a mental affliction in the Muslim world. And if only we got rid of that, then, you know, we'd be so much more better. But that requires a revival of thought, revival of actually ability to think rationally, which we did have and we lost. As for you say, you know, Muslims should eliminate problems in our own community. Now, obviously, I agree with Miqdad in that that shouldn't be a prerequisite to counting people for committing injustice. You can't say to other people that, okay, actually, I'll let you commit injustice because I have to solve all the injustice elsewhere. No, injustice is injustice. You have to speak out against it. However, you have to understand, bad Muslims have always existed, will always exist. Bad Christians, bad Jews, bad atheists. Literally, there is no such thing as a utopic community or society. It is impossible. Now, all I have to do to demonize a community is patiently wait for just one criminal amongst them to be a paedophile, to commit murder, to kill his wife in a crime of passion, which if a Muslim does it, it's called honor killing. But if a non-Muslim does it, it's just called crime of passion. And they will just wait and then put all the press in that one story and ignore the other stories, which show that actually this is ubiquitous. Yeah, like, take the Rochdale rape gang. They were drinking alcohol and having, licentious, you know, sex outside marriage. Is that Islamic? Is that an interpretation of Islam? You know, were they doing that in the name of Islam? No. They were integrated. But we assume that integration means that you will follow the best of the whole society. But does not the whole society also have a dark side? And cannot people integrate into that dark side as well? And that's what they did. These Rochdale people integrate into the dark side, which is basically people, you know, doing bad things, which every society has. And so how can I make our society perfect when no human being, I mean, like, what's this kind of holy grail methodology whereby you can render a human society completely perfect, you know, devoid of any imperfection? It is impossible. The real problem is the media focusing on the bad and not looking at the good. So when Muslims have the Global Peace and Unity event, where 55,000 Muslims turn up to it, and they have these talks by speakers who condemn terrorism, and 55,000 people, right? No mainstream media turns up. It's not newsworthy. It doesn't sell newspapers. Who wants to see a touchy-feely good story about Muslims? No one's gonna, you know, buy that if you put it on the front cover of Daily Mail. It isn't going to sell. So that's the kind of issue. The last point I will say is that living in Britain, you know, you said that they have some Islamic elements of their society. I mean, like as I said, as Christianity, as Judaism has, you know, similar Islamic elements as a communism. Communist countries have similar Islamic elements of hating the misdistribution of wealth. I mean, obviously, any good points which we see reflect virtues. In any society, we'll say, yeah, that's Islamic or that's Islamic. It's not. I'm not saying it's Islamic because I'm a citizen of Britain. It's because it's a virtue that we recognise within Islam. But at the same time, I think, you know, we should also not be afraid to stand up for what we believe in, and not necessarily try to couch our language in a discourse of you know, British or American politics, but to be who we are. Because I think the misunderstanding about Islam is that if the people only see You know, radical Muslims on one side who apparently spout the Quran, and they see Muslims on the other side who look very kind of secularized. Then it reinforces the idea amongst the mind of the people in the West that Muslims are only good if they don't follow their belief. You see, and that's very dangerous. And and I think lastly I'll say, people say, where is the silent majority, right? Where is the silent majority? Well, considering that we have demonstrations condemning terrorism which dwarfed the EDL's demonstrations condemning terrorism, like more Muslims have publicly demonstrated against terrorism in one sitting than EDL could bring. It's not the case that we're the silent majority, that if we're not being reported or given a platform for mass distribution, which the media has a monopoly on, we are the silenced majority.
I mean, the idea that sort of Muslims are the problem in themselves, that there's division in the communities. I mean, I think obviously there you can kind of take the sort of funny side of that thing. I mean, you see that the stories about sort of Zionist sharks attacking people in the Red Sea and that kind of thing, or you know, spy vultures that fly in from Israel, that kind of thing. So, I mean, I play cricket with a lot of Pakistani guys who have some interesting conspiracy theories about Pakistan, which is always good fun to chat, and you know, it's a good laugh to talk about. But I mean, I think you have to be careful suggesting that. I mean, that is the only end to it. I mean, there is no doubt that there is a serious issue between some Sunnis and some Shia in the world. But I mean, I think it's not dissimilar to the problems we saw in Northern Ireland in the 70s, where you know there were two communities living close to each other, and of course you know they create stories sort of. Belittling the other community as an other, you know, as an evil. And you know, they're both Christians, but just coming from kind of different backgrounds. And you know, they kind of bring all their political affiliations and you know ethnic affiliations into this one kind of big melting pot and create this kind of horrific sectarian identity that basically just rips a community apart down the middle. And I think to that extent, I think the willingness I've found of some Muslims to engage in sectarian kind of ideas, you know, the thing that I mentioned about London Met Islamic Society, where you know, yeah, you can like what you like on Facebook, but why in that case are you liking, you know, very unpleasant sectarian Facebook page? You know, that is a problem, I think, and that is something that can easily be cut out as well. It's something that the Muslim communities can kind of think, you know, is this the kind of way we want to be portraying ourselves, you know, as divided? Or, you know, do we, you know, should I be thinking about that? You know, should I think, how would I feel if I knew that, you know, perhaps as a Sunni, the Shias were liking Facebook pages where there are pictures of Sunnis being killed, or, you know, pictures of, you know, FSA soldiers holding up Alawite heads, or that kind of thing. So I think in a lot of cases, it comes back down to that kind of common decency thing at a very sort of fundamental level. I mean, In terms of asking Muslims the problem, I think possibly the actual problem is that a lot of Muslim states currently, I'm not suggesting are you know run on Islamic lines. I know there's a lot of kind of antipathy towards that idea. I know most Muslims wouldn't think that Iran is actually run along Islamic lines or Saudi Arabia. So what I mean by that is countries that have majority Muslim populations. Tend to be weak states. Essentially, they're currently they struggle with internal violence. And again, like I said, a lot of this is to do with power. So, for example, Yemen, which is one of the weakest states in the world, is divided essentially into three different warring factions between sort of Houthi tribes in the north and you know secessionists down in the south, and then you know, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and Ansar al-Sunnah down in the south, who are kind of just causing all these problems. And when your country is weak like that, I think it's very difficult for government to get a handle on the problem, but also very difficult for individuals like yourselves who'd want to stand up and would want to you know have these rational debates to get a handle on the problem. I mean, we saw in Pakistan where senior politicians kind of stood up and said, look, there is an issue in our community with you know sectarianism and people being accused of blasphemy, and they were assassinated. And when you have a state that struggles to control violence like that, you will end up with the people who have guns and the people who are willing to use guns coming to the top, and the extremist dialogue being the one that gets picked up on. And I mean, I am not going to pretend that I know how to solve that. I mean, it's an incredibly difficult issue when you're faced with a community or members of a community who are intent on using violence and are cowing, like I said, the majority into submission. I mean, I would argue that there is a silenced majority in Afghanistan. There is a silenced majority in parts of Pakistan who are very unhappy with the actions of these sectarian armed groups, but have been silenced by the fact that people who stand up to these guys get killed. So, I mean, in that sense, I think that's one of the problems. And I mean, I don't know how you solve that. I mean, I think possibly one of the best ways is it's cooperation. It's for states to, you know, to come together and work out, you know, how are we going to stop this kind of thing? I mean, if, for example, I go back to Afghanistan and Pakistan, where you have a border between the two countries that is essentially porous for militants to cross from either side to the other. You know, militants that are attacking ISAF and NATO troops in Afghanistan, or that are coming the other way and are attacking Pakistani troops in places like Swat. I mean, until the two countries can kind of work together to close that border down, you are going to end up with an area where it's very easy for groups to exploit sectarian hatred and exploit sectarian tensions. And, you know, you can understand how people would look at that and think the Muslims are the problem. I mean, I think in the majority, I think, you know, as with any religion and as with any group in society, the vast majority of people just want to get on with their life and they want to, you know, be able to do the things they want to do. I don't think they actually, you know, they think about sort of sectarian issues or, you know, whether or not they hate Mrs. Jones next door because she's a Christian or something like that. And so I think we should take heart from that. I think just in certain areas there are real issues that need to be dealt with. And I think, like I said, the only way to deal with that is by cooperation and also by, you know, sort of, I don't know, perhaps in some cases accepting that, joining kind of a sort of more global community and accepting some of the aid from the West might help. I mean, for example, you see in parts of Pakistan where vaccination programs are attacked by militants. That's the kind of thing that you would think as sort of parents, people would be able to stand up and say, no, sorry, that's not something that we want you guys to be doing. You know, that's not in the name of Islam or anything like that. To be honest, I think it's a very tricky question that's going to take quite a long time to answer, unfortunately.
Okay, it's getting quite late, so I'll just say 1 minute for closing remarks, starting with
Well, I would say that a lot of issues are marked. Just to get back to the topic of today's discussion, which is freedom of speech. I think that the purpose of freedom of speech is commonly agreed to be the pursuit of truth, so it should remain the pursuit of truth, not the pursuit of dehumanizing, insulting, humiliating other human beings, which we know by human nature that humans hate being humiliated, hate being insulted, and demonization and scaremongering leads to violence, it leads to discrimination, and we should be against that. But there should be open discussion on all things, including sectarian issues within Islam. If we actually had objective intellectual discourse rather than demonizing hatred and rumor mongering, we'd actually get somewhere with, you know, and we could coexist peacefully, but have a very vibrant and healthy intellectual atmosphere. I mean, just because in an intellectual atmosphere might be, you know, combative, doesn't mean that people can't, you know, live civilly. And I think it would be a very healthy for the Muslim society to have an open arena for intellectual discourse, a marketplace of ideas, as they would say. In terms of, I said, foreign policy, and this is obviously the issue about foreign policy, how it bleeds into the discourses within the Muslim world, and how Muslim world issues bleed into the issues of Muslims in the UK. I mean, okay, look, you know, Muslims have opinions about, we have opinions about foreign policy. We you know, some of these opinions are controversial, but we should also, you know, be open about them and restricting us from openly discoursing about this and under the guise of, you know, extremism. You're extremist, you can't talk about Afghanistan, you can't talk about Israel. So I would say that basically, you know, as Muslims, if we want to say that the occupation of Afghanistan is illegitimate, that every country, every nation has the human right to fight against that occupation, and that Pakistan, before Pakistan and Afghanistan can cooperate, the sovereignty of Afghanistan must be decided by the indigenous population without outside interference and aid to the Egyptian military, which is essentially a mercenary force, should be ceased. And Muslims should actually have our own independence where we can now decide our own destiny. And then maybe that will create real solutions in the Muslim world and ease issues, but at home as well. Sorry.
I'll try and keep on. I mean, we did get a bit off topic, I think, in the end. I think that's usually the way with this kind of thing. I mean, I would simply just get back to what I said, if we're going back to the topic, to the things I said in my opening kind of comments, that freedom of speech, obviously, I think everyone accepts there has to be a line, as said. You know, and if you're going to come out with freedom of speech that's attacking the adherence to, or, you know, that's attacking religious individuals in an attempt to incite hatred against them, obviously that's completely unacceptable. But religion itself, I mean, I think should be open to parody, at least, because you know, parody can be amusing. It may be hurtful to other people, but people shouldn't not have the right to be able to make that parody. I think you know, they should consider common decency, as I mentioned, and I think before you come out with something like that, you should always sit down and think, am I going to offend someone here? Am I going to be hurtful? If they offended something that I felt this clearly about, would I want them saying it? And I think that's really the key here. I mean, in terms of the foreign policy thing, I think I'll leave it there, just because otherwise we'll be here all night. But yeah, I think my main point would just be you have the right, and you should have the right, to, you know, not to have to abide by other people's religious sensibilities. But when you're around them, and when you're in close proximity with them, and when you go to university with them, probably should at least have some kind of respect for them, I think.
Thank you. And so we've talked quite a lot about the sort of freedom of speech and where this red line is, and I've always had a view that it doesn't matter where the red line is. It's something that has to be developed through a whole range of different methods, and depending on the society you're living in, it's far more subjective than anything. I don't think Islam necessarily has a view on it, and this idea that we need to be scared of being of someone insulting us, I think sometimes we don't give Islam enough credit. You know, from a solely religious perspective, which may not necessarily be applicable everywhere, we know how you know, when Abraha was coming to go and destroy the Kaaba, we had Allah came and he comes and the pebbles come and they destroy the whole army. We know how Prophet Muhammad had so many times when everyone wanted to kill him, and he was able to go into the cave and he was saved. We know the situation that God's going to protect our religion, right? From an internal religious perspective, we don't really need to worry about that. What we need to worry about is the society we live in, and making sure that red line works for us and the community we live in. If there is a case, because we're being discriminated against, because we're marginalized, because we're the Irish of today or the Jews of 50 years ago, and there's a problem there, we should fight it. But I don't necessarily think it's an Islamic perspective to come out and talk about it in that respect.
Final interesting point. Thank you very much for your time. And thank you very much for everyone attending.
Excellent.
Well, this is it.